Hi, this is Troy Stangerone, your host for Korean Context. On this episode of Korean Context, we speak with Jerome Sauvage, Deputy Director of the United Nations Development Programs Representation Office here in Washington and former UNDPRK coordinator, about his time working in Pyongyang and the humanitarian situation in North Korea. I'd like to welcome Jerome Sauvage from the United Nations Development Program onto Korean Context this week. Mr. Sauvage, you served as the United Nations resident coordinator in North Korea for 3 years, and you opened the UNDP's office in Pyongyang. What can you tell us about life in North Korea?
Well, it's definitely isolated, no question about this. You know, there's not a whole many ways to get in and out of North Korea. It's also a bit isolating because, well, you don't really mingle with the population and the locals. So we all live in a compound, and it does feel at times a little bit isolated. Having said that, there's a lot of very good, interesting things about the daily life in North Korea.
Speaking of that isolation, what was your ability to travel the country and see what life was like, you know, to be able to contrast what the life of maybe the average North Korean, if you will, would be in Pyongyang, as opposed to maybe, you know, other major cities such as Kaesong or Nampo?
Yeah, that is one of the advantages of working for the UN. The UN has food delivery and projects pretty much all over the country. I was lucky to travel outside of Pyongyang, from Chongjin all the way down to Kaesong, Dandong to Wonsan or Hamhung. I've seen all the major cities, and I've also been in the countryside. So I've seen quite a bit outside of Pyongyang.
Is the difference very stark? Or because one of the things that's often, you know, discussed is this idea of sort of where the economy is going. And we often get these sort of slice images from people who go on a week-long trip or something, who talk about the boom in Pyongyang, if you will. And then is there booms in the other major cities as well? Or if there is a boom per se, and how different is that from the countryside?
There's no question that you have to get out of Pyongyang. Pyongyang is a little bit of a showcase. So even in Pyongyang, by the way, I always tell the travelers to look behind the buildings, to try to peek in order to see a little bit behind that showcase effect. But clearly, the big difference is between the countryside and Pyongyang, and to a lesser extent, some of the towns, cities, Wonsan, Kaesong, Hamhung. I wouldn't say that there is a boom, that is too strong a word, but there is some change, some growth, some markets. But the countryside is where you really see how the people really live. You notice the lack of energy around. You notice how people go around, and you certainly notice how people work in the fields.
During your time in North Korea, you were there from roughly the end of 2009 to the beginning of 2013. You saw the transition from Kim Jong-il to Kim Jong-un, certain key moments such as the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth and North Korea's successful satellite launch. During that sort of slice of time, did you see significant changes taking place in the country, or was it more sort of a continuation of what had come from before?
Yeah, well, I arrived in November 2009, and 30 days later, we had the redenomination of the won, in which overnight you find yourself, when you were holding 100 won, you were only holding 1 won. And I had to buy furniture. I had to buy furniture for my house because I had arrived 30 days before. And everything was padlocked. There was no way I could have entered. No markets, nothing, no shops. And from that period on, basically, the 3 years of my time in DPRK, I have seen what I would call the return of the markets. I've seen, if you will, what probably was before I arrived, 2008, slow but certain return of market activities in the street. But initially, it was absolutely nothing.
from an American perspective, you know, a lot of our apartments are unfurnished, but when I've lived overseas, oftentimes the apartments are furnished, and I would have thought, you know, there'd be something similar in North Korea, but it's interesting that you arrive and you have to take and sort of purchase everything, but there's nowhere to buy stuff. And
yeah, that's the UN. One thing, I was opening the office, so I hope my successor has found the apartment to his liking. But my wife and I had to indeed equip ourselves like we do in every other country indeed. And there are shops, there were initially, now I mean there are shops where we could get furniture and things like that.
Was there, out of curiosity, any type of shop that surprised you that was there that you thought wouldn't have existed in Pyongyang?
Yes. There were a shop that we called the Japanese store. The foreigners called it the Japanese store. I don't even remember why. Which was selling very nice watches, fairly fancy watches that I myself would not afford. And so that was one such store that I had noticed. Was a bit of a surprise.
Interesting. Since you opened the office there and you talked about, you know, for your own apartment, you had to buy the furniture and everything. And I guess those are some of the practical day-to-day challenges of living, you know, in North Korea. What were some of the other challenges that you faced in opening up the office and that other international aid organizations face working in North Korea?
Yeah, what you had to do very initially is you have to define the expectations very clearly. There is what the UN can do and what it cannot do. And this was part of a dialogue with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, being clear as to the kind of programs that we are in a position to deliver and those that which unfortunately we're not in a position to deliver. So that initial work was very important.
In terms of the types of things the UN can do in North Korea, could you give us a little bit of feel sort of for what type of work the UNDP was doing in North Korea and the types of projects you were working on there?
Most of the UN program, I should say, is humanitarian. And UNDP is also working closely to provide services directly to people. Two types of program we were doing as far as UNDP was concerned was two agricultural projects. One, to show at the farm level how to better protect crops. They lose about 30% of their crops due to storage problem, and we were trying to offer very practical solutions. And seeds diversification, the quality of seed is not very good. And the second group of projects was rural energy, showing at the village level the kind of renewable energy solutions you could have, such as solar, wind, biomass, that you could apply at the level of a community.
Looking at this issue in terms of the agricultural side of things, when we think of the challenges North Korea faces from a developmental standpoint, we often hear a lot about, well, there was a famine in the 1990s, and there's often debate about what types of food needs North Korea has, you know, whether they have enough cereals, whether they can't. You had mentioned, I think you said they lose 30% of, you know, the crops. In a general sense, sort of, what is the capacity of North Korea's agricultural system to actually provide the food its population needs?
The capacity of the country to provide food for itself, and you know it's one of their goals, it's this juche, self-sufficiency, also in food, is not very high. They're doing the best they can. But number one, you have to look at geography. I think it's 80% of the country, which is mountains. Therefore, you have only 20% when you can actually grow food. Traditionally, North Korea was an industrial mining kind of country, and the South was more adapted to agricultural development. So it's kind of a reverse. Also, back during the time of the Soviet era, North Korea had relationship with, the agriculture was very mechanized. Lots of fertilizer, very mechanized, no animals. When it all collapsed around 89, they found themselves with basically no capacity to grow much food. So they start from a real deficit from the perspective of their own capacity to grow food. Then you add climate. It's a tough climate. It also has regularly from June to July floods. So basically you have an agriculture which is incredibly fragile, completely unable to respond to any shock. And all it takes is a bad rain, a bit too much or a bit not enough, and you find yourself with a serious food problem.
Yeah, and we've seen, you know, in recent years, flooding issues and things in North Korea impacting the food stocks. In 2012, you did a report on sort of the developmental situation in North Korea. About a third of children are stunted, and that between the ages of 48 and 59 months, it's 47% of children. What do we kind of really know about the nutritional situation because of the agricultural situation in North Korea?
Yeah, so this report is a UNICEF report, 2012, and I don't think there's been one since then. The number of about, as you were saying, almost a third of the children under five that are basically chronically malnourished is very high for the region. It shouldn't be. And the other number is what we call acute malnutrition, and that's 4%, which is also, according to UNICEF, too high. Unfortunately, we're now looking at, since 1990, this has been going on. We're almost at the level of a generation that has been chronically malnourished.
Is there anything we can look to sort of in other countries in terms of what a generation of a malnourished population means for a country's long-term development?
Well, we're seeing it in Korea. If you now start to look at the basic size of Koreans south of the border and north of the border, there is already serious differences. I've been told, and I've tried to verify it, and I think it is true, that malnutrition becomes trait of a society, if you will. Therefore, veritable DNA, or the trait of the North Koreans, will differ increasingly from that of the South. So that's very, very interesting. So I think we can already show physically the difference. The other impact is going to be cognitive development. The lack of food for children and students in general will mean a lesser ability to develop cognitively, intellectually. It'll really have an impact on the population.
It's very interesting. I mean, the long-term effects aren't just simply in that one generation, both in terms of physical development and, you know, educational development, but that it also potentially then extends to future generations because of that. When we think about the well-being of the society, it is more than simply nutrition and the agricultural sector. One area that's obviously important is public healthcare system. What do we know about the current state of the healthcare system in North Korea and how it's able to address the healthcare needs of the population?
I traveled extensively and I visited a whole lot of facilities. I can tell you the healthcare system is unable to provide any kind of health services to the population. It has collapsed. Today, basically, you're talking about no equipment. And I mean, for example, certainly no heat and no water in the hospitals. And no supplies. And by that, I mean no medicine, no anesthesia. Most deliveries are in a very natural way. So the health system is basically broken.
If there isn't medication and the healthcare system is not able to take and provide preventative care, then I assume as well. What does that mean when you take and you sort of factor that in with the malnutrition issues in terms of diseases that impact malnourished children that perhaps maybe wouldn't be as large of an issue if the population was better fed? One of my colleagues, Karen Lee, who used to be the executive director of NCNK, she would talk a lot about the underreporting of the TB problem in North Korea. What does, I guess, this then mean in the broader sense because of the healthcare system?
You're mentioning TB. To me, TB is a disease of poverty. And this is really what we're seeing. This is a system that probably could control how well people are taking their TB drugs, for example. That would not be necessarily a problem. But you're having basically the sanitation environment, the cold, bad nutrition are absolutely factors for fast development of TB. Also, this problem of malnutrition is that people eat all kinds of wrong things. I went to a hospital once with President Jimmy Carter, who visited, and we were told that these people in that ward had eaten grass and had gotten sick out of it, all kind of intestinal problems. So poverty, basically, is what we're talking about. Lack of care are creating very serious problems among the population.
So if desperation is leading people to eat grass as opposed to other things, are there crops that they're growing that maybe they shouldn't be growing that perhaps aren't the most nutritional? that might help address that? Or are there other things they should be putting in their diet that either traditionally or for other reasons they're not?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Even in the 3 years I've been there, I've seen crops change. I think, and I don't have the data to show you, but I think they're moving a bit more away from rice, which takes a lot of water, to corn, for example, which they can grow pretty much everywhere on every hill. And so one is more corn. But beyond cereal, the World Food Program and FAO in their crop and food assessment in the last 2 or 3 years have been very clear. They need to diversify the diet. They need to find a way to acquire protein and vegetable and fruit. And for the moment, this is wholly lacking.
You had mentioned issues with water. Water is essentially the basis of life. What is the current state of water supplies in North Korea and sanitation? Obviously, a lot of diseases can be carried through unsanitary water. How does that impact the population?
One of their problems has been that they used to have pretty good systems, good pipes, up until the 90s. And so basically now you have these pipes that are broken. And you will have the sanitation system and the water supply system basically mixing each other and getting people very sick. There's a lot of diarrhea in the country. It's comparable to some of the most difficult cases that we have in other countries and in the developing world. It's really comparable. And water is a major problem. The other problem we don't know enough of is pollution of the water. Industrial pollution to the extent that there is, but also pollution due to all the equipment from the Soviet era that are leaking into the water. So they're in a bad shape at that point too.
One of the interesting things I saw once was that companies now are doing much more corporate social responsibility work. And one of the things that I thought was interesting is that, and this is a point where I guess sort of business interests and community interests sort of overlap, but Coke, when they go around the world, because yes, it costs far more than it would be worth to take and produce Coke in the United States and ship water essentially overseas, when they build the plants, they often take and do sanitation issues in the water. Given the level of sanctions and everything, it might be difficult for Coke to set up in North Korea, even if North Korea wanted them to come in. But should we be trying to encourage or look for, because North Korea is looking for Western investment, trying to match up companies that might have a corporate social welfare interest as well in North Korea with their own economic interests?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Coke, because actually UNDP works with Coke, not in North Korea, but with quite a few places to work on water sanitation issue. This is one of our best partnerships. And so I really like when you're mentioning this. Yes, if there was a space for corporate social responsibility for firms to come in and assist, obviously South Korean firms had done a little bit in the past, I think, that would be wonderful. It's just that for the moment, there is hardly any real foreign investment into the country. But if South Korean firms could come and do work on that, it would be very good.
Given the time you spent in North Korea and the work you've done on the humanitarian issue, we've talked about the agricultural side, we've talked about things like water, nutrition, disease, healthcare. What do you think is the most pressing or urgent area to actually address? Because it's often difficult to take everything on at once. So where should we be putting a lot of our resources?
I think three areas. We need to continue, unfortunately, to focus on food. Assist the North Koreans with their food supply, but not just giving them food, but addressing the chronic incapacity of North Korean agriculture to produce more food. So that means obviously working on crop fertilizers, probably. Second area is going to have to be health. And for that, not very complicated solution, not big solution, but local level, providing at the very decentralized, very community level, if you will, supporting dispensaries and district level hospitals. That would be very important because there's not a lot of transportation. It's not easy to go to a referral hospital, provincial level. I would say to continue to push for using markets for access to food in general, access to items, mostly obtainable from China, but also, and services. You get some services through the market in DPRK, and I think we need to, and we're doing it when we write the food and crop assessment report, WFP and FAO encourage the reliance on those small market, the farmers market, to really use more of that in order to support better. Because without that approach of using local markets, the public distribution system is not able to provide to the people.
If we're looking towards the markets as helping to supply, one question then becomes, you talked about how the healthcare system doesn't have the equipment, the drugs it needs, that actually after the end of the Soviet Union, the mechanized side of agriculture collapsed. Is the difficulty in North Korea the lack of funds to keep the systems going and to take and bring in new equipment? Or are the way our sanctions designed currently inhibiting their ability to import the equipment they need to farm and the types of machinery they need for the hospitals and the medicines?
Well, I should say we face three problems in trying to bring assistance to the people of DPRK. One problem, frankly, is access. We have difficulty accessing some part of our project or to do it on time. So that's one problem that we need to address. The second one is data. We don't always know enough. We don't have enough data to know exactly what is needed and where and how. And you cannot bring any piece of equipment, for example, without knowing kind of where it's going to be, what is the use of it, how we're going to be. So the whole data thing, we need to improve on that very much. And finally, yes, infrastructure. There is no infrastructure within which we can provide assistance. So, you know, we have to be a bit careful in how we are approaching the assistance, because as long as those three dimensions are not well addressed, it's going to be very difficult to do any more increased level of assistance.
You previously were posted in Vietnam, Cambodia, Pakistan, India. In your experience, what type of developmental aid is the most useful, especially in the long run, in terms of helping the population and then helping development?
In my experience, you have to really rely on people. You have to bring their own capacities to find solutions. One of the things that is striking about the North Koreans, the Korean population, is their resilience. They are extraordinarily resilient. And they are able to work well, able to do what you have to do through hard work, discipline, commitment to their family, commitment to improving their situation, either way they can. But we need to support them. So we need to support them in direct ways, through food, health, and so on, and also train them, show them what are the possibilities, show them how things are being done outside. The UN does that a lot, showing what can be done in neighboring countries or elsewhere. It's that kind of usage of other solutions that I think is really to shore up the ability of the people. That, to me, is the most successful way to help a country develop.
Did you find North Korea to be receptive to that type of advice? I know, in terms of their economic zones, they've been trying to bring in international experts on how to set them up. Do they do that as well on the agricultural side and the other developmental issues?
I would say it's a discussion that we do. A tendency of many of these countries is to want the equipment, and only the equipment, and we'll take care of the rest without thinking of maintenance and training. We tend to want to shift the order around. First the training, first the capacity of people, then the equipment can follow. So, you know, it's a bit of a discussion sometimes. But eventually, they are partners in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, for example, or a technical ministry. They understand that this is, as I was saying at the beginning of the interview, that's all we can do, is provide that training, is provide that support to people. And eventually, well, it gets, I would say, it gets accepted.
Mr. Savage, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Korean Context. It's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Troy.